Let's try that again. Welcome everyone to the OUJLIC Medical and Halakhic Lecture Series, starting with today. Today we are hosting Rabbi Gideon Weitzman from the Pua Institute, Machon Pua. I'm just going to give you a few words about Rabbi Weitzman to give us the most time to hear all of his awesome words. So Rabbi Weitzman is the director of the Pua Institute. He heads the English department of the Pua Institute. He was born... I actually thought he was Israeli originally. Rav Weitzman was my teacher in Midrash Harova, and I spoke to him in Hebrew. I heard his class in Hebrew, and I found out he's British. So he's born in Britain. He studied in the Beit El Rabbinical Seminary and earned his smicha from the chief rabbi of Israel. He founded and chaired the Kansas City Community Kollel, and afterwards, after many years, he came back to Israel and joined the Pua Institute. He's also a visiting associate principal in the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. He's also a regular contributor to the annual Halachic Compendium Tchumim. He also publishes scholarly papers such as Genetic Counseling for the Orthodox Jewish Couple Undergoing Preimplantation Genetic Diagnosis, in addition to other articles. He's lectured in many organizations, including National Council of Young Israel, Rabbinical Council of California, Agudas Yisrael of America, as well as other academic forums such as Columbia Medical Center and Cornell Medical Center. In his presentations, Rav Weitzman demonstrates the synthesis between medicine and Jewish medical ethics. And in the past 2 years, Rav Weitzman has developed and taught online courses for fertility treatment and their interface with halacha. Rav Weitzman also teaches at the Gris Kollel in Israel and Midrashah College for Women in Jerusalem, and simultaneously is the rabbi of the Merkaz Modi'in Synagogue in Modi'in. He's also published 3 books on the philosophy of Rav Kook. So he's really awesome, and that's why when we heard Rav Weitzman is coming to town, we said, book it. You can just read the email. And on a personal note, as I mentioned earlier, Rav Weitzman was my teacher in Midrash Harova 10 years ago in Machshavat HaTfilah and in Rav Kook. And he was also my husband's teacher in Gris Kollel in Tarad Mishpacha and Hilchot Nida. So without further ado, thank you so much to the Pua Institute for the wonderful sushi. Thank you, Rav Weitzman. Thank you, Leah. And thank you, everyone, for coming. We hope you enjoy.
Thank you so much. Wow. Thank you. It's... This is the second time I've been here in Queen's College. You sound like very far away from me. Anybody here? Yeah? Should I come here? Like we're here? Are we good? Yeah? Okay. So, the second time we're back. And it's a pleasure to be here. You're very lucky to have them on campus because they've met a very special couple. And not because I taught both of them. Like, they know stuff that I didn't teach them. So, it's an honor for you. And it's fun to be here. So we're going to speak about Moses, from Moses to Mendel. So this guy, Gregor Mendel, was a Augustinian monk friar in Austria in the 19th century. And, you know, monks have a lot of free time. Like, rabbis are always busy, they have to learn daf yomi and prepare shiurim. And monks have a lot of time. So he had a lot of time on his hands. And he grew pea plants. He grew thousands of them. And he noticed something very interesting, that if you look at the way that pea plants work, I don't know if anybody knows too much about pea plants here, but pea plants can be tall or short, and what he noticed is that if you have tall parents, they don't always produce tall children, because we have a recessive gene that may appear in a generation, and will skip over one generation because it's recessive, but will then be expressed later on. So that he discovered, and he's really considered to be the father of modern genetics. And he published his paper, and 50 years, the scientific community across the board completely ignored his writing. So here he is working in his garden, and here he is being ignored for 50 years. Nobody took any notice of Mengel. So don't worry, if you're a scientist, or you're doing anything worthwhile, don't worry the fact that people ignore you for 50 years, because in 50 years' time, you can become as famous as Mendel. As here is how we talk about genes today. And in fact, we described that if you want to know anything about a gene path, there's something called OMIM. OMIM is the online Mendelian inheritance in man. We call it Mendelian inheritance today when we speak about giving over genetic traits. And genes determine every single thing about us, because how we're going to look and what our traits are going to be and our intelligence and various diseases that we may catch is all dependent on the work that Mendel did. What's fascinating, though, for me is that That's not such a new idea. That's new for the scientific community. But it's not actually so new, because our rabbis already spoke about this. This is a piece of Gemara in Masechet Nidah. The Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, there are three partners in the creation of a human being. Everybody knows this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Aviv Imo, God, his father, and his mother, her father and her mother. But that's known. But what's less known is the continuation of the Talmud, because the Gemara then says, what do they actually give? So we could say, what are your parents' parents? Because they raise you, they look after you, they educate you. The Gemara says something very different. The Gemara says, Aviv, Mazriya Haloven, the father gives the white substance, Shemimenu Atzamot, and from that you get the bones, the Gidim, and the sinews, the Tzipunayim, and the fingernails, Umoa, Shebarosho, and his brain, the Loven Shebayin, and the white of the eye. Imo Mazrat Odem, the mother gives red stuff, Shemimenu O, Ubasar, Vesarot, there we get skin, and flesh, and hair, the Shachor Shebayin, and the pupil of the eye, the Kodesh Baruch Noten Baruch, God gives spirit. Uklasteo panim, and how we look. Veriyat einayim, the ability to see. Ushmeat ozen, the ability to hear. Vidibor hapeh, the ability to speak. Vehiluch arglayim, ubina, vasken. Everything that's beyond the physical. But what do parents give? Why do parents become parents? Because they give white stuff or red stuff. They give the genetic material that's going to determine what you're going to look like. So the Gemara seems to suggest that parents give over genetic material to their children. That's how they become parents. So that's a little bit of conjecture. I told this once in the Midrash Rava, and a Talmidah said, but it's not true. Father doesn't give white stuff, mother doesn't give red stuff, so you can't take it half and half. So I conjecture a little bit, but this Gemara that we're going to look at today does speak about, almost exclusively about an idea of genetic, of something like Mendelian inheritance. The Gemara says in Masechet Yefamot, anybody who's learning Daf Yomi learned it not so long ago. Tanya, mala rishona umet. Umet, shnia umet, sheni umet, shlishi lotimol, divrei Rabbi Yonatan, divrei Rabbi. Says the Gemara, the woman does circumcision for her first child, and he dies. She does circumcision for the second time, and the child again dies. The third child, we don't circumcise. But Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, Shalishi Timol, the third we do circumcise, Ravi Lo Timol, we don't do circumcision on the fourth child. And what really we're discussing is probability. If the first child died because of circumcision, what's the chance of that happening a second time, or what's the chance of that happening a third time? What's the Gemara really speaking about? The Gemara is really speaking about this, which is the explanation of what we call hemophilia. When we get an injury to our blood vessels, the body has the ability to create a clot and to block it up, and we don't bleed to death. So normally that's what happens. Someone has hemophilia, doesn't have what's called factor 8, which is an ability to create platelets, and so that plug isn't formed, and therefore that person dies, continues bleeding and bleeding and bleeding, and eventually dies. That's what happened to this child when we did Brit Milah. Now, what's the possibility of that occurring in the same family more than once? Well, here's the rub. Father, right, has XY gene. Mother has XX gene. The hemophilia is an X-linked genetic abnormality. It means it's carried on that X gene. So mother has another X gene to overcome it. So mother's going to be healthy. However, if she gives it to her male son, that problematic X gene, because he doesn't have another X gene to overcome it, he's going to get hemophilia. And so it makes a lot of sense that if a mother sees that her first child dies of hemophilia, dies after Brit Milah due to hemophilia, that could well happen to the next son. It won't happen to her daughters, but it could well happen to her next son. And here's where it becomes interesting. The Gemara then says, these are sisters, right? I think these are called the Dooley sisters. They were a pop group in the 70s, well before most of you were born. There was a case of four sisters. That's the same Gemara. Betzipori, in Tzipori in the north of Israel. Shemala rishona v'met. Shniya v'met. Shlishit umet. Revi'it bat lifnei Ramasham Shimon Gamliel. The case was that not a woman had her own three children. There were four sisters. One had a son and did Brit Milah and died. One had a Brit Milah and did. One had a... And the fourth sister comes and says to Rabbi Gamliel, who was the Rav of Tzipori, Amar la al tamuli,
Don't do Brit Milah on your son, your first son. Why? The achayot mechazkot. What does that mean, achayot mechazkot? What's chazaka? What's a chazaka? How do we translate chazaka to English? Huh? Chazaka in English is chazoke. But how do we actually translate? What does it actually mean? Chazaka means there's a high probability, or there's a good chance that if this happened to one or two sisters, it's going to happen to the fourth sister. What basically are we saying? Let's look at this chart. What happened here? We have a father with hemophilia, a mother who's a carrier, her daughter is a carrier, which means her daughter then goes back here. So if she has four daughters and they're carriers, what is going to happen in the next generation? The sons are all going to get hemophilia. What basically is the Gemara saying? We're drawing up a family history. What happens when a person has a genetic abnormality? They go to a genetic counselor and they draw up a genetic history. If this happened in one generation, you have a grandmother that's got this, and a sister, and a brother. So what's the probability of happening? That's exactly what the Gemara says. That's what it means, l'chayot mechazkot. What is the probability of such a thing happening to cousins? Now, we have to understand the ramifications of what the Gemara just taught us. Because if we say that we don't do Brit Milah for the first son of the fourth sister, not doing Brit Milah, But if a man is obliged to do Brit Milah and doesn't do it, then he's chayav karet. He's cut off. That's a really serious thing. That's like eating on Yom Kippur, eating chametz on Pesach. Not only is he chayav karet once, every single day that he doesn't do Brit Milah, he's chayav karet. And what is the Gemara saying? We don't do it for that fourth sister, even though we don't know that she has. She has no previous history, only because there's a chance that if sisters have a problem, the cousins are going to inherit the same genetic abnormality. Now that, I think, is a fascinating explanation of Gemara. Because the Gemara is basically saying what Mendel said in the 17th century, the Gemara was saying already 2,000 years ago. That we understand that there's a probability, there are genetic traits that are passed from one generation to another, and definitely here, since it's an excellent genetic abnormality. And here we have a presentation of exactly what the Gemara just said, that if we have mothers or mothers who have genetic abnormalities, how do we look and see that that expresses itself in the next generation? So the Gemara already spoke about genetics. The Gemara says in Masechet Yevamot, Lo yisa adam isha lo mishpachat nechvim ve'lo mishpachat metzoraim. A person should not marry a woman from the family of Nichvim or from the family of Metzoraim. So Metzoraim, Sarat, people heard of? Sarat, what is that? What's Sarat? No? It's Sarat, it's like we call it leprosy, but it's not really. But it's something like leprosy. What's Nichvim? Nichvim is something that we probably don't know. Nichvim, probably something like epilepsy. Again, what's interesting that Gemara says is that it doesn't call them don't marry a person who has a genetic abnormality. What does it say? Don't marry someone from a family of a genetic abnormality. Meaning that the Gemara already understood. Look at this family. They have a chazakah. They have a probability that one person, another person, that's likely to be something that's passed on from generation to generation. So they already understood this concept of hereditary traits that are recessive sometimes. They don't express itself in every generation, but maybe. So they call it mishpachat hanichvim, mishpachat hatzoraim. This is a great Gemara. The Gemara says in Masechet Bechorot, Gavoa lo yisa gavohit. A very tall man shouldn't marry a very tall woman. It's very important to know when you go get married, guys, okay? A very tall man should not marry a very tall woman. Shemi yetzemim torin. Lest they come up with a flagpole. They're going to come like with a really, really tall guy. Right? This family, this couple are okay. Like, you know, they're good. They're also nanas lo yisa nanasit. A small man shouldn't marry a really small woman. Why? Shemi yetzemim etzbei. Lest they're going to have a finger, like a little, tiny little thing. Because it's going to be, like, expanded. Lavan lo yisa levan. A very light person should marry a very light person. They're going to have an albino. A dark person should marry a dark woman. They're going to have someone who's like totally black. So we don't exactly agree with the genetics here, but the idea again is that we see that genetic traits are amplified from generation to generation. Chazal already understood. Our sages were pretty smart. Not pretty smart, they were incredibly smart. They already understood that they observed the inheritance and the hereditary traits that were passed from generation to generation. And here's one of the examples. All right, what does that do for us? Let's say a little bit about, anybody here studying biology? Yeah? Okay, so you are now exempt from the next three slides, okay? You can talk, you can eat sushi, you can do something else. Everybody else has to listen. Now, you probably learned something as well. It's okay.
So, Jeanette, anybody studying a little bit about biology will know that all of us come from a sperm cell, an egg cell, that came from that each has 23 chromosomes, which is half of the genetic makeup. And together, it's 46 chromosomes, and this is what we all look like. I mean, we're not all as beautiful as that, but we all, you know, that's basically the idea, is that we all have 46 chromosomes. What are chromosomes? Chromosomes are a map that tell us how we are going to look, how we are going to be. It's basically a roadmap, how we're going to be built. It's a list of sugars that come together to create traits. And it's a very, very extremely complex list of numbers or list of data that's stored in a way that we don't actually know how to use, that we, even in our computer age, don't know how to create something that's similar to that, of how we can use the same amount of information that can be used in multi different levels. So it's really an amazing information. What it basically says is what we're going to look like, what we're going to be, and of course what gender we're going to be. So XY is going to be male, XX is going to be female. And here we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. They're called, very excitingly, you're waiting for it, pair 1, 2, 3, 4, until we get to 22. And then it gets really exciting, X and Y. That's it. That's what we call them. Why is that important for us? So we know, for example, on gene 15, we've now mapped the genome. We know how the genome is created. On gene 15, for example, we know exactly what's called the genetic, thank you very much, the genetic marker. For example, on Q26 on gene 15, which is a specific point, is a genetic abnormality called Bloom syndrome. Has an incidence of 1 in 100 every Ashkenazi Jew. It's a propensity to getting all sorts of cancers. Maybe we'll mention it later. Tay-Sachs, everybody's heard of. Tay-Sachs appears, we know exactly where it is. It's on Q23 or Q24. We know exactly the location on that gene, on gene 15. Marfan syndrome, a dominant genetic abnormality, is on Q21. We know exactly where they are. Today we've mapped the entire genome. And everybody in this room can go for a small fee and can get your gene map. You'll come up with a computer disk that your entire genome. It'll tell you what you have, what you may get, what are your propensity for disease. It's an important information. There was a law that was almost passed in Israel. It was badly worded, so it didn't get through. There was a law that was almost passed in Israel that every single child that is born, automatically we will test their genetic makeup and they will have a genetic code. And you're going to need that. So not today, but in 10 years' time, if you want to get health insurance, they won't give it to you unless you've had your own genome checked. If you want to start in certain jobs, they won't get it unless you've had your genome checked. That's going to be the norm. We're going to know exactly the propensity that you're going to have for disease and what it is you're likely to get. My brother worked at one point in the Salk Institute, and they had a special that you could check. Then it was $2,000 to check your genetic, to get your genome checked. He could check it in the Salk Institute for $500. He said, okay, $500? That's a good deal. Not so much money. I'm going to check it. So he went and he's got a book at home with his own genome. A woman in his shul in San Diego said, I'm also going to get my genetic. That's a great idea. And it's going to cost her $2,000. Now, $2,000 is a lot of money. He said, what are you going to do with that information? She says, well, I'll know that I have propensity to all sorts of diseases. So he said, and what are you going to do with that information? She said, look, if I know I'm going to get certain diseases, so I don't know, I'll eat more healthy, I'll do more exercise. He said, lady, I can save you $2,000 now. From now, eat more healthy, do more exercise. It's always a good idea. But some things we do want to know. Because, example, if you're a carrier of Tay-Sachs, you're perfectly healthy. Now, it's 1 in 30 amongst Ashkenazi Jews, so we're not going to frighten anybody, but there are 30 people in this room now. A little bit more than 30 people. But it looks to me, there's some of you colouring. I'm going to hazard guess most of them are from Ashkenazi. Right? So without pointing to who that is, somebody here is a statistical average. Somebody here is a carrier of Tay-Sachs. Not Tay-Sachs, it's some other genetic abnormality. Now, that's not a problem. When it will be a problem is that if you marry, if you're a carrier of Tay-Sachs, which is a recessive genetic abnormality, you marry someone else that has that, two recessive genes, like we saw in Mendel's pea plants, can create a child who has the disease. And that we don't want to have. So that's important to know. And
There's another possibility of genetic abnormality called a trisomy. A trisomy is instead of having a pair, you have three. More is not better. So here's trisomy 21, the most famous trisomy that we call Down syndrome. Down was a huge anti-Semite, so we don't like to call it Down syndrome. So we'll call it trisomy 21. Trisomies we can have in all of the gene pairs, apart from one. Anybody in biology, what gene pair can't have a trisomy? But that's a really tough question, because most people don't know that. I've talked to biologists that have PhDs and all of that. It's actually trisomy 17. We don't have trisomy 17. Apart from that, we have for all of the gene pairs. You've never heard about that. Anybody heard of trisomy 18? You know anybody that has trisomy 18? No, why? It's not compatible with life. They can't live. If you have trisomy 18, you can't live with it. And so most of the trisomies, we can't live. That's why Down syndrome is so famous, because you can live with it. And we know the results of kids with Down syndrome. So we spoke a little bit about how do we get genetic abnormalities. Autosomal recessive means that only if you're both carriers will the child be ill. Like in this case, we have carrier mother, carrier father. Here's unaffected son, but here's affected child. But we also have what's called dominant, which means you don't have to both have it. Once we have unaffected mother, but we have affected father, he is going to give it to two of his children, 50% chance of giving to children, because it's dominant. Dominant means that it will always express itself. Now, there are certain genetic traits that express themselves. Eye color is a dominant genetic trait. That's not so terrible if you have one. You know, you can always put in contacts and change your color. It's not so terrible. But having Marfan syndrome, having Gaucher, that is serious, because those are also very, very, have a huge impact on life. And we also have, of course, X-linked, like we saw before, hemophilia, which means it's not, mother is carrying, she's not ill, but she's going to give it. If a son gets it, he doesn't have that X that can overcome the effect of it. So how do we create healthy families? How do we create healthy marriages? So many people have heard about Doi Sharim or other such testing. The idea is the following. There was a man in Brooklyn about 30, 40 years ago, who had a child that died of Tay-Sachs. Now, just don't understand what Tay-Sachs ever heard about. Tay-Sachs is the inability to, it's a lack of an enzyme that breaks down fats. Everybody here ate fat. We just ate, there's not too much fat in the food we just ate. But, you know, tonight's food is going to be more fatty, probably. So we all eat fat. We eat fat, what happens is our body breaks it down. Tay-Sachs doesn't have that ability. So what happens, a child's born healthy, they can't break down the fat. Fat you have in everything. Fat you have in milk. Mother's milk has fat in it. So the child starts ingesting fat, it can't break it down. It gets fatty deposits, and they start being in the legs, and in the arms, and in the heart, and eventually the child dies between 6 and 2 years is usually the lifespan. So his child died. He said, I'm the last person that's going to happen to. So I'm going to go and check everybody, and we're going to tell you, if you're a carrier, don't marry a carrier, and that's it, and we'll basically eradicate in one generation genetic abnormalities. So he went to all the rabbis, and all the rabbis said he can't do that. A thought. Why? Go back to one of the previous slides. Remember we said you shouldn't marry a woman from the family of Nichfim? A family that's sainted, don't marry them? So we're going to create more and more and more Mishpachat HaNichfim. Because if we have everybody who's a carrier, you're going to say, oh, I'm a carrier. So then we're going to be Mishpachat HaNichfim. So he said he can't do it. So he came up with a brilliant idea. Jews don't give up so easy, you know. So he came with a brilliant idea. Is we're going to have secret testing. We're going to test you. You're not going to tell you what you get. You're going to get a number. When you come to get married, you're going to check your number, 123456, against the spouse's number, which is 98765. And if there's no problem, so you have different, you're carrying different genetic abnormalities, it's not a problem. Or you don't have any genetic abnormalities, it's not a problem. And if there is, it's going to tell you there's a problem with the marriage. And he went to the rabbi and said, that's a great idea. And that's what he did. And it's a unique program, Doi Sharim. It is unique. There's nothing like it in the world. We've traveled around the world. We've literally traveled all over the world. That's why you go in America anyway. And we met with genetic companies. And they're saying, no one's doing this. I mean, this is really an amazing, amazing thing. We basically eradicated Tay-Sachs in one generation. What's the problems with it? Well, it's closed, which means you don't know what you have. Now, we want to know what we have. The other limits are, it's good if you're Ashkenazi, marrying Ashkenazim. That's not always happens in our communities. And it doesn't help, of course, if you've got a dominant genetic abnormality or if you have a familial, something that only your family has. It doesn't check it. And it's great if you're in Shidduchim, like, you know, you meet someone like and the parents already agree to it and you test first. But if you, like, I don't know, go to Queen's College and you meet someone in one of these this halakha and medicine sort of events over sushi, it doesn't really help you, because you're not going to test numbers before you swap I used to be telephone numbers. I don't know what it is today. Probably nobody has telephones anymore, right? So whatever it is, whatever the equivalent is. So today there are other organizations, this is just one of them, that does open genetic testing. And there are many, many companies today. It's maybe you've probably heard like 23andMe. Anybody heard about that whole debate about it now? So it's about, that's home testing. But there are actually companies that do, you should know that it's available and it can save lives. Today most insurances cover it. Why they cover it? Because it's cheaper for me to test your genetics before you get married than it is to pay for your health, unhealthy child. And so it's actually encouraged a lot by the insurance companies. You should know that. It's an important thing to know. What about people that doesn't help for them? What about in cases where we're already married and we finally have a genetic abnormality? A woman came to me, I got a call about 2 months ago from a rabbi in South Africa. He said there's a couple, they met, she knew she had a genetic abnormality, so she offered the test, and he's tested, and he's like, no, go and make shit of him. He has the same genetic abnormality. So what should they do? They want to get married, what should they do? And then about a month ago, she came to see me in my office. And then a week later, he came to see me in the office. They came from South Africa, especially Jewish Island, to meet with us, to speak to us. And this is what we can suggest. What we can do today is something called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which basically means, here we have a fertilized egg, and here in the cells, in the nucleus of these eggs, we have the DNA, small amount, that you're going to have for the rest of your life. Once you're conceived, you get the same DNA. So we can test it right after conception. So what can we do? So we can do an in vitro fertilization, which means that we create fertilized eggs in the lab. And then we can take out here, this was an old way of doing it, is that it was used with light. You could see that this is normal or abnormal. Then it was done with PCR. And today we're basically doing this DNA microarrays. We can basically take a cell or a number of cells. We can analyze them. And we can say either it has the affected gene or it doesn't have the affected gene. So we have two people that have the carriers of Tay-Sachs, or two people, or a woman who's got hemophilia, or any other familial or dominant genetic abnormality. We can do an in vitro fertilization. We can create fertilized eggs. We can take the cells, we can analyze them, and we only put back in the healthy embryos. And we now really can eradicate disease. Really, we can change the world in your generation. That just doesn't happen. When I got married, we didn't have this. But when you're going to get married, you have this already. That's already around. So we can now eradicate disease. And this is an amazing, amazing technology. Why should we be using it? Well, it's very exact. We know the genetic markers. We know on that Q15, remember on that gene 15, we can see where Bloom syndrome is? So we can eradicate it. It's only a fetus. It's only a fetus. We'll see in a moment that. It's a developing art. It's got multiple uses. It's something that is only going to develop more and more and more. And we can use it for many, many genetic abnormalities. In fact, what we can do now is even better. We can now take the cell, we can analyze the genes, and we can, even if you don't have a genetic abnormality, we can make sure that we've got a perfect child. Oh, wow. Anybody here read Brave New World by Aldous Huxley? Yeah, you read? Anybody here studying English? No? You studied English? Yeah? Nobody studied English? Yeah, one person. Two people biology and one person. What else everybody have studying? What else is that? I know you're doing math. No. What else? All right. So he speaks about that, about creating a perfect world, right? Creating a perfect world, so he speaks of that. Why should we not do it? What's the problem that we're doing PGD? It seems like I just saw all the problems of the world in one slide. What's the problem? Well, it requires a medical treatment. That means this young lady who came to see me a month ago, she can't get pregnant naturally. She can only get pregnant during a medical treatment, which has ramifications for her life. It's going to restrict the number of children that she has, right? To say, maybe I want to have more children than the amount. Every time I'm going to have to do it, it's an expensive procedure. I'm going to have to do a treatment. It's not always successful. There are side effects. And of course, there are ethical and halachic questions related to fertility, to doing PGD, which are not so simple. And that's what we're going to speak about in the next few minutes. Okay, everybody with me? Yeah? Wonderful. All right. What are the halachic questions? What's the status of an embryo? Is a person meant to undergo elective treatment?
And then essentially, you know, there's no obligation to do that. What happened, this woman, I said to her, when she came to see me, I said, you know, if you'd have been born 20 years ago, you wouldn't have this question because you would have had children. They would have died. You wouldn't know about it. You wouldn't, and now we have the ability, but it's still elective. No one's forcing you to do it.
And what are the boundaries of what is permitted? Not everything that we can do, we should do. All right? So what is the status of an embryo?
The Gemara already spoke about that. The Gemara Masechet Nidah says,
Ad alba'im, until 40 days, maya ba'almahi.
Until 40 days, the embryo is considered to be just water. Now, it's not water. It means fluid. It means it's cytoplasm. It's not considered to be life. That's actually against the position of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is of the strong opinion that once you put sperm into egg, it's life. We don't hold by that. We say that 40 days is what determines that it starts becoming life. Especially when we're talking what we call ex vivo, outside of the body. In the body, that's a different question. But outside of the body, that's not considered to be life. So an embryo is only an embryo. It can be destroyed.
In fact, everybody's heard about stem cell research and all these sort of sexy things. Yeah, that's not always. It sounds much more cool than a lot of it is. But that's we have in Judaism no problem with doing stem cell research. Stem cells are not considered to be life. The Catholic Church does, which is why certain Christian religious groups in this country are very much opposed to stem cell research because they think it's already life. We don't. The rabbis were never against it. What are the ethical barriers? What parameters? What can we do and what should we be doing?
What about this question? A person is a carrier of Tay Sachs. They're not ill. They're married to a non-carrier. But the woman says to me, and I hear it, and I've heard this several times from women or from men, I had it bad when I got married. I have to say I'm a carrier of Tay Sachs, and I had to ask, and there was a guy that I was really... I really wanted to marry. He was a carrier. We did get married. I don't want my daughter to go through that. I want to do PGD in order to ensure, not that my daughter is going to be healthy. She's going to be healthy because I'm only a carrier. But she's not even a carrier. So that's already now test the limits. Should we be doing this treatment not to eradicate disease, but to eradicate potential disease? On the other hand, you could say that's great. Hey, if we really do it for everybody, we can eradicate all disease within one generation. Everybody here only has children through PGD. All the genetic abnormalities you have, we would in one generation erase. That would be great, right? As a little bit of a quote. There was an article in The Lancet, in one of the British medical journals, that said that every single human being has 300 genetic abnormalities. I'm sorry to... You think that, you know, everybody thought they were so perfect and they were wonderful. Everybody else here. So I have a cousin who's a genetic counselor, and I spoke to her about his papers. She said, of course it's not true. Of course it's not true. It's more like 3,000 genetic abnormalities. Right? Everybody has genetic abnormalities. So we can't really eradicate them, but we could eradicate the known ones. But a carrier's not ill. What are the ramifications of the future? Can we do PGD for social reasons? Not for medical reasons, but for social reasons. So let's see, who thinks we should? Who thinks if you're a carrier of Tay Sachs and you married a non-carrier, you'd want to do this procedure in order not to have a child who's a carrier? Who thinks they would? Who thinks they would not? Okay, so a lot of people here don't think, which is problematic, I think. And maybe you're thinking about other things. If most people wouldn't, people are against that. You wouldn't do it for social reasons? Okay, let's look at another question, which is a little bit more home to home. What about for gender selection? Hey, what's the most common genetic abnormality? Being the wrong gender. It's the most common genetic abnormality, especially if you're Chinese. I was supposed to be a girl. My parents until today are very upset that I was. Well, my father very upset that I wasn't, that I'm a boy. Now he's starting to come to terms with it, you know, but it took him like 45 years. Call me a girl. So he... I asked my father, what happened if in your time, we're only boys in my family, what happens if in your day you'd have had the opportunity to do PGD and to select girls? Would you have done it? My father said, yeah, of course. My mother was a little less enthusiastic. My father was, yeah, of course. So who thinks we should be able to use this to check, to select gender? Who thinks that? Who thinks no? Everybody's got to think now, because I know there's some people who aren't thinking. There's still a few people who are not thinking. Yeah, everybody says no? All right, I'm going to give you a couple of cases and you'll see what you think. Okay?
You're fine? You're good?
Yeah.
Okay. So... had a case. There was a very famous case in Israel I was personally involved with.
There was a case of a Kohen who had what's called Klinefelter syndrome, which is a genetic abnormality. Instead of being XY, he's XXY. So the problem with that, one of the applications, he doesn't produce sperm. So he had to use he tried lots of treatments, eventually used a sperm donor. And the sperm donor that, according to the tshuva or Moshe Feinstein that he got, that was forbidden, that's a complex issue in itself, but that's what the tshuva that he got.
It can only be with a non-Jewish donor. Now he's a Kohen. Which means that his child
will not be a Kohen. Right? You understand that? So in America, so whatever, we once occasionally do Birkat Kohanim, but in Yerushalayim, where he lives, we do Birkat Kohanim every day. So every single time that once his child gets to be, 9 or 10 or 12, Bar Mitzvah, he's going to go up, the father, and the child's already got, they're going to say, hey, what I thought. So then he's going to have to say, oh yeah, it's a sperm donor. Now, if anybody here has bought from a sperm donor, you don't want to tell anybody that. That's information that we don't share with people. So would that be a case in which we'd be permitted to use gender selection to create a girl in order to cover his embarrassment of him and his wife? Who thinks yes? As you're shaking your head, you still don't like it? Why not?
No, he's meant to have a boy, he's meant to have a boy.
Okay, what do you think? What? Alright, so that was the same thing. The Shuvah or Moshe Ponshi, okay, I'm a non-Jewish. That would be a good idea, but he didn't get that Shuvah. He didn't get that answer. His answer was because I'm to be non-Jewish. Who would say that in that case it would be permitted? Yeah, someone? Come on, no? Yeah? You think so? You think what? Why?
Yeah, I remember the Gemara or whatever, Leah afraid that she didn't want to have another son because that would mean Rachel wouldn't have two sons. It would be an embarrassment.
That's a very good source. I never thought of using that source for that,
but that's a great source. Gemara must have had Rachel. So, in the end, we debated it like you had here, and in the end, we permitted, he got permission to do it.
And the doctor was so excited that he did it. He went to the press and said, hey, look what we did. So the guy came to me livid, like, I'm to blame. Like, now I'm the source.
He said, everybody's going to know it was me. I said, why? He says, because it says in the newspaper, Mr. Cohen from Yerushalayim. So I said to him, I pulled out the Jerusalem phone book. And I said, look, this is a Cohen. There was 14 pages of Cohen. It's one of these. Right? But I don't know. Anyway, he was really annoyed. He didn't want to speak to me. He didn't speak to me for a year.
And then about a year later, he came to me and said, okay, when can we do it again?
Now I have two girls, now I have a family. That's a case in which I think that there is, maybe we could
argue that there is case, and other cases that we could think about that. Had a case of the couple, there was a couple in Canada, that they had three girls. After the first girl, the wife was very upset because her father had been a Holocaust survivor, and he had died, and she was the only survivor of his, and she wanted to call a child after him. Someone should continue his legacy. After the third child, the third daughter, she was almost suicidal. She had psychological treatment, didn't help. She was really, really in bad shape, and she called me up desperate. She wants to have a boy to call after her father. So, who think that's the case then?
Nobody? People who were okay, you think they're okay? Why?
I don't know, they're carrying on here.
What? You think so? You could do it?
She's having psychological trauma over it, and it's really very important.
Right. And maybe not for me, but it's for her. Yeah, you think still not?
Well,
I can't convince you?
No, you convinced me now. Because the other reason was for embarrassment, and embarrassment is like somebody dying. Well, this one, she's suicidal, that's also somebody dying.
It's almost like. She got her permission, and she did it. I went to see her on a Friday morning,
and the whole family was different. All of the four children, she had a much more positive attitude to her, and I thought that there was maybe a case in which it was appropriate. So that Shabbat, I was in asked to speak in a shul in a synagogue, and I spoke, and I mentioned this. It was a similar talk to here, and I mentioned that.
And I changed a lot of details that I changed here. No one recognized it. You won't recognize who it was. And her husband was in the audience. And he came to me after and said, wow, that's a great story. My wife had a similar story today.
So it was, all right. Let's look on a little bit. But look at another thing. Let's look at this. We spoke about this also a couple of years ago. We spoke the same thing.
Case of hunger. Let's talk about this. This interesting case, which I don't think there's an answer. Maybe you come up with a good makor as well.
I like your makor. So a guy has Huntington's disease. Huntington's disease is a
body wasting disease. You're perfectly fine until age 45, 50, and then your muscles start degenerating, and a person ends up in wheelchair lolling. So a guy has it, he has a son, and the son sees his father, perfectly healthy, and then in middle age, he becomes in a wheelchair. He doesn't want to be like that. But he doesn't want to know that he's got that, because if he got it, you can't change it. But he doesn't want his children to have that. So he goes to the doctor and says, do PGD to make sure that my children won't have Huntington's disease. But don't tell me what I have. I don't want to know. So the doctor does PGD, and he sees not only are all the children healthy, but in fact the guy, he can see from his genetic makeup, he doesn't have Huntington's disease. He's fine, you don't need to do it. So the doctor wants to call him up and say, you're fine, you don't have to do it. The problem is, what will happen the next time that happens? The doctor doesn't call him up, so what will the guy then know? Hey, if you didn't call me up, I must have it. So can he continue doing PGD for the first person in order to save the second person? And that's a huge debate among ethicists, is that are we allowed to continue doing PGD to save society? Really the question is, who's our patient? Is our patient this couple? Is our patient the child born? Is our patient the good of society? How do we define a patient in that case? What about the case of BRCA? BRCA gene is a common gene, genetic abnormality among Ashkenazi women in America. Just to understand, in the regular populations, the incidence is about 0.3. In the Jewish Ashkenazi population, the incidence is 2.5%. So it's basically an inability. Everybody has cancerous growths, and now you're all going to come out. You've all got genetic abnormalities, cancerous growths. But everybody has cancerous growth. That body knows how to address them. Someone has BRCA, doesn't have that ability, so instead of destroying the genetic cancerous growth, our body doesn't know how to identify them, doesn't know how to destroy them. And BRCA has a greater propensity of getting genetic abnormalities. Should we be doing PGD to ensure that the children will be healthy? So I'm going to tell you the answer that I think. I think the answer is no. I tell you the reason why. BRCA, everybody should be tested for and should know, because there's certain lifestyle and ramifications for if you do have it. However, it's talking about people that are going to get cancer maybe in 40 or 50 years' time. Now, we don't know, nobody in this room knows where cancer research and cancer treatment is going to be in 40 or 50 years' time. What I can do is I can conjecture. Let's look back 40, 50 years. 50 years ago, in North America, they sold cigarettes by saying, your doctor smokes Camel cigarettes, or 80% of doctors suggest smoking Camel lights. That's how they sold cigarettes. Now we know, of course, that cigarette smoking causes cancer. So to think where we're going to be in 50 years' time, I don't know if we're going to need to now create children that maybe be healthy there. So we have to think about that as well. We have to think about, is this what we want? Is this the perfect child? You know, we're looking for something that not everything we can do, maybe we should be doing. Maybe we don't need to go and look for perfection. Because, and this is a great book, anybody wants to read like a really good book on biology. Sean Marlin was like a big upcoming star. He wrote this book called The Survival of the Sickest, in which he claims, and it's a very interesting claim, that genetic abnormalities are not always bad. For example, he works on this, which is hemochromatosis, which is the inability, which is too much iron. Too much iron is not a good thing. But, and he writes about it because his grandfather had it, and he thinks it's, you know, that's how he got into genetics. So people have too much iron, and that can really do bad things to your system. Like you can be iron overload can affect a lot of the organs of your body. But his claim is that the people who survived the bubonic plague had this genetic abnormality. Maybe some genetic abnormalities enable us to overcome certain types of disease. For example, we mentioned before Bloom syndrome. Bloom syndrome is getting cancers. And it affects men, they get a lot of types of cancer. They don't get one cancer, they don't get men with Bloom syndrome. They don't get prostate cancer. What is it in that genetic pathway that stops us getting it? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is much more, he works out the world in a much more complex way. And in fact, the Rambam already wrote in the Ilchot Girushin, Hayadevi Be'olam, there was a plague in the world, like bubonic plague. Vamran, a woman said, Meit Ba'ali, my husband died. Ne'emene, we believe her. Why? She developed pashut b'fi kol ha'adam. Because a simple thing that everyone knows, she b'shnat ha'devet, that in a time of plague,
in a time of cholera, to use a coined phrase. Zechai v'zemeit. Some people live and some people die. V'yafshash yemutu b'devar na'arim chazakim. Sometimes strong young people die. V'yinatzlu azakenim acholim. And old sick people live. We don't know why. There's something beyond just the disease that keeps us alive. Maybe that is the survival of sickness. Maybe one is right. That sometimes we have genetic abnormalities that make us, that overcome our ability to succumb to plague. Maybe there is something in Bloom syndrome that keeps us healthy. So I have a good news for you. My child's not perfect. And I'm happy that that's the case. And nobody here is perfect as well. But if there's cases in which we can eradicate serious disease, then we need to think about doing it. The question is, what is our ramification? How do we upset the balance of the Kodesh Baruch Hu's world? And so, not everything we can do, we should do. We need to learn how to use genetics wisely. We need to learn how to use PGD wisely. But what's the wonderful thing is we all come from a tradition that never, ever stopped technical advance. There are other traditions that sort of have a very ambivalent approach to medicine, not Judaism. We always saw that medicine, medical advance, technology, and God always went together. It was never a problem with using technology. The only question is how do we use it? So we need to use it. We need to use it wisely. And you need to know that it exists because you're going to be the generation of genetics that is going to use it much, much more probably than my generation, and to create maybe more healthy children. So that's maybe the end, or maybe it's just the beginning. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If anyone has, there's actually some extra time for questions. If anyone has any questions for Weissman on anything.
Yeah.
Not much. What are the issues of using Jewish sperm donors?
The question that Rav Moshe Feinstein heard about during sperm donor was a question of possibility of siblings marrying each other. That maybe we're going to have a case that siblings are going to marry each other. And therefore, in order to overcome that, he said, if you have non-Jews, so then there's not a question of yusin, it's not a question of the marrying. That was what Rav Moshe Feinstein discussed. Anybody else? Yes?
So there are two things. There's post-testing, your experimental testing.
Yes.
Which one do you recommend?
That's an excellent question. The advantage of closed testing is you don't come out with mishpachat hamikvim. We don't come up with people who are maimed. On the other hand, I think that a lot of time we want to know what we have. Like if I have something, I want to know. I don't think that having a genetic abnormality is abnormal. Like I said, everybody has them. The question is how severe it is. So I think that I would recommend for people that want to know that information, open testing is a good thing. But you have to be able to understand the ramifications of that. And I think that mostly in the modern Orthodox world, we're going towards the modern direction of open testing, and to know what we have. We want to know. Sometimes those things are important. Sometimes being a carrier has ramifications. So we need to know, like testing for BRCA8. That's important to know. You have to know what we're going to do with that information.
And the testing process has evolved so significantly in the last couple of years that they're able to identify very early many genetic abnormalities that prior to that they were not able to.
Right.
And it's a little